This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
One of the things that I have always believed in and I try to follow is to be prepared for the unexpected. Because one of the... You must have heard of Murphy's Law, and Murphy's Law says that if it can go wrong, it will. And I think that's a very good law to keep in mind, and I thought it's a good... Example that you are seeing here, hopefully it was not wrong, but things will straighten out quickly, and I think they have. So I can now, after my informal beginning, I can begin formally. Your Excellency, Indian Ambassador to Kuwait, Mr. Sunil Jain, Your Excellency, Abdulaziz Adwaij Sheikh, who is also a dear friend of mine. My dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I was asked to give this speech, and I always tell people that you should be prepared to understand that there is no such thing as a free meal. That applies to lunch and it applies also to dinner. And the price of this meal for me is to sing for my supper, and for you is to put up with that. To humko bolna padega, aapko jhelna padega. We talk about these qualities of top achievers, and this is one of my, it's my passion, it's my specialization. I do this internationally, I do this with all kinds of people, I do it with students, with teachers, with civil servants, with politicians, with religious scholars. One of my first assignments was with the Apostolic Carmelite Church, with the nuns and the priests of the Roman Catholic Apostolic Carmelite Church, all the Mount Carmel schools and colleges all over India and Sri Lanka, so there were 200 or 300 of them. So all kinds of people, and I deliberately do that because it helps me to get a taste of different aspects and different parts of society, and you'll be surprised how different people are from different parts of society. So even though we might all look the same and we may even talk similar languages, but we also have our differences. That is my CV there. My brother Siddiq Walaikat introduced me, but I usually put up my CV so that then I can start getting some job offers. I want to start with one of my favorite quotes, which I use all the time, which is a quote from the Smritis, where it draws our attention to a very important aspect of learning. And that aspect of learning has to do with our own participation in the learning. And this gives us an idea of the importance of participation, a person's own participation in the learning process. I hesitate to pronounce the Sanskrit for the, in case I make any mistake. So, if I do make any mistakes, please forgive me, but this is how I was taught to pronounce it. Acharyat padam adatthe, padam shishya swamedhaya, padam sa brahmachari bhaya, shesham kala kramena cha. And this is, it means a person can get only one quarter of knowledge from the acharya, from the teacher, another quarter by analyzing himself, a third quarter by discussing it with people, and the last during the process of living by his own understanding of addition and deletion and correction and modification. And I think this is a very important aspect of learning to keep in mind. So as I was saying, that it underlines for me the importance of a person's participation in the learning process. To go forward, one of the things that I always believe in, and I've mentioned this many times, is not how much you know, But how much you do, that makes the critical difference. There are many instances in life where at the end, it is action which counts. You can know a lot, but if you don't act on it, there will be no result. So my question to you is this. I want to begin with this question. My question to you is, what do you intend to do with your future? And I'm asking each one of you this question. What will you do with your future? Have you given it some thought? What will you do? What do you intend to do with your future starting today? You have two choices. You can choose to survive, or you can choose to live. Because to live is not merely to draw breath. Living does not mean breathing alone. So what is the choice? Today is the most important day of your life. And that's not because I am speaking to you, but it's because today is the only day that you have. Yesterday is gone, tomorrow we don't know whether it will come. But today is what we have. So whatever we did yesterday may or may not matter. Tomorrow we may have aspirations, but we don't know whether this will, we actually have the time to do that. But today we have. And the question is, what do you want to do with that? And that's important because what I do today, what you do today, has the potential to impact the rest of my life, the rest of your life. So what do you want to do? I'm not asking you to give me an answer now, but give it some thought. And one way to arrive at what you want to do is to ask yourself this question and say, what do I want to be remembered for? When we are gone from here, not necessarily, I don't mean dying, I mean when we leave this hall, when we leave a job, when we finish an assignment or whatnot, what is it that you want to be remembered for? I think that is a very good thought to have before we begin any assignment. Not at the end. Before we begin the assignment, ask yourself this question. At the end of this, what do I want to be remembered for? And that's why I want to share with you my motto in life. And my motto in life is, I will not allow what is not in my control to prevent me from doing what is in my control. And no matter what situation you might find yourself in, whether you are a powerful person or a rich person or a powerless person or a poor person, no matter what, there is always something in your control that you can do. But the reality of life is, many people do nothing, and if you ask them, they say, they globalize the issue and they address it in global terms. For example, if I ask you, since all of us are Indians here, or most of us are Indians here, if I ask you what according to you is the biggest problem with our country, and you might say illiteracy. So if I ask you now, how can you solve the issue of illiteracy in India? And 9 times out of 10, the person will tell you, well, how can I solve the problem of illiteracy in India? I'm only one man. I am one person. But if I change that question and I ask you, can you pay for the education of one child? One child only, not two. Can you pay for the education of one child? Now what is the answer? And if every one of us pays for the education of one child, and if we promote this message, then a time will come when there will be no illiterate people, because everyone would have had access to at least basic education. So globalizing a problem is a way of copping out. Localizing the solution is a way of finding solution. That's what I mean when I say, I will not allow what is not in my control to prevent me from doing what is in my control. So what's our world today like? I want to give you a very brief glimpse of that. I love statistics, so I'm going to give you some statistical numbers for you to mull over. We live in a world of contrasts. We live in a world that speaks to us in sign language, readable only by those who can see. And by see, I don't mean look, I mean see as in understanding. And that's why I like this quote of Neil Gaiman, who said, "There's none so blind as those who will not listen." We believe in this world today as we live, that we believe that we are at the peak of knowledge, especially scientific knowledge. We think that we know better and more than anyone at any previous time in history. We believe that we are at the peak of civilization. We believe that we are at the peak of prosperity. There's more money floating around today than there was ever. And we believe that we have the secret of everlasting happiness and contentment. My submission to you is, all such claims must be substantiated. So let us look at what the numbers tell us. So here are some numbers for you. We believe that we are committed to eradicating hunger. How many times have you heard this from the speeches of all kinds of people? We want to eradicate hunger. But what does the data tell us? The data tells us that 3 billion people live on less than $2.5 per day. Tonight, as we speak and as we eat our dinner, 1 billion children in the world will go to bed hungry. 22,000 children die every day due to poverty. Every day. On this planet, 805 million people do not have enough food to eat. 750 million lack adequate access to drinking water. In many countries, including in parts of my country, not having adequate access to drinking water usually means that the women, not the men, the women have to walk miles with a pot on the head to get hold of water, which in any case is hardly worth drinking. My question to you is, what according to you is a basic necessity? And I can almost guarantee that not one of us in this room will be able to define basic necessity as it is defined by the people that I'm talking about. Because for most of us, and especially our children, an iPhone 6 Plus is a basic necessity. A Samsung S6 is a basic necessity. A Samsung X5 is old hat because a new phone has come on the market. Nobody is thinking of bread. Nobody is thinking of one roti. Nobody is thinking of an old shirt. Yet they are also living in this world. Let's look at food wastage, and I'm giving you data from FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization of the United States, of the United Nations, which says that $4.4 trillion worth of food, enough to feed 3 billion people, was wasted last year. And 3 billion people are the number of people who are estimated to go to bed hungry. Pile all that food on a football field and you will have a casserole rotting miles high. Discarded food. Figures of 2014. USA, 34.7 million tons worth 162 billion. UK, 7.2 million worth 17.7 billion. And India, $9.2 billion worth of food was wasted last year. And that's why I say, humbi kisi se kam nahi. We come back to my motto, in the words of Mother Teresa, who said, if you can't feed 100 people, feed just one. So let me stop here and ask you, how many of you are willing to take with me an oath now to say that from this day onwards, you will ensure that one person is fed by you every single day? Are you ready? We believe that we are committed to the protection of people and the environment. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention says that in 2013, somebody died by suicide every 12.8 minutes. I submit to you that happiness doesn't cause suicides. Despair does. The Worldwide Fund for Nature's Living Planet Report, which I call the Dying Planet Report, 2014 said that in the last 40 years, the number of animals in the world, wild animals, has been halved. 50% of wild animals that existed in the world in the last 40 years have disappeared, have died. And that's only the ones we counted. Question is, if we really believe that we are at the peak of knowledge, how come we are destroying ourselves? Does it make sense? I was speaking last week at Oxford at the International Conference on Education, and I presented some of the same data there, and that was the question to me. I said, we are here in an institution which is over 1,000 years old, and we believe that we are at the peak of knowledge, then how come we are destroying our world? So I said, a time may come when archaeologists digging the mound of what used to be our times will wonder how people who knew so much still managed to destroy themselves. We believe that we are committed to eradicating poverty. But here are some figures about how the wealth of the world is shared. 0.7% of the people in the world own 41% of global assets, and 68.7% of the people of the world own 3% of global assets. And that's a cartoon which is not funny. And so is this, which came out in 1997 on our 50th Independence Day. I submit to you, therefore, that the single most powerful change to transform the world is to move from the position, the world is responsible for me, to the position, I am responsible for the world. My question to you, is this a logistics or resources issue, or is it an issue of conscience? Big question. How do you define achievement? You're talking about qualities of global achievers, so I thought to myself, let me tell you about some achievers and ask you to define for yourself what is achievement. Is buying a car achievement? I don't think anyone has that thrill anymore. I mean, this, we don't own one, we own many. Building a house, not a thrill anymore. So what is achievement? So let's look at three top achievers historically. First one I want to present to you is a man called Genghis Khan, who was neither a Muslim nor a Pathan with that name. Genghis Khan was an animist in terms of his religion, and Khan is a title in Central Asia for any kind of a leader. 1162 to 1227, he lived for 65 years. Out of 65 years, Genghis Khan, about 20 plus years out of the 65, he lived as a fugitive. It's an amazing story to read. There is a biography, I've read 5 of them, of his. There's a biography of his by a man called Mann, who's written this fantastic biography of Genghis Khan. And it's an amazing leadership book to read. I strongly recommend that for you. So out of 65 years of life, he spent 20 years as a fugitive, and in the 65th year, he was killed by his second wife, which also is a lesson for people who want to marry again. Now that is a map of Genghis Khan's empire. It is the largest landmass ever in the history of mankind to be ruled by one man. 12.7 million square kilometers. Largest landmass. And he did that by himself in a period of 40 years. All of China, all of Asia, halfway to Europe, ruled by one man. To give you a comparison, that is the empire map of the empire of Alexander the Great, 2 million square miles compared to Genghis Khan's almost 13 million square miles. That is an empire, that is the map of the Roman Empire at its peak, 1.7 million square miles, smaller even than the empire of Alexander the Great, and by far almost one-tenth the size of the empire of Genghis Khan. That is the Umayyad, the Muslim empire at its peak, of the Banu Umayyah, 5.8 square kilometers, about less than half the size of the empire of Genghis Khan, but bigger than the Roman Empire and bigger than the double the size of the Roman Empire, more than double the size of the empire of Alexander the Great, but less than half the size of the empire of Genghis Khan. So what were the principles of leadership of Genghis Khan? One, strict meritocracy without exception. I actually teach a seminar on Genghis Khan's principles of leadership. I'm not going to do that here. Maybe we do that some other time, but it's really worth studying. Not everything is worth praising. I'm not praising some of the things that he did, obviously, but definitely worth studying. Strict meritocracy without exception. If I give you some of the examples of what he did, it helps me amazingly in my family business consulting, especially succession planning. One of the major reasons why family businesses do not last more than three generations is because of the inability to take hard decisions. Genghis Khan took very hard decisions, very, very hard decisions. Number two is intense physical training and toughness. The key weapon of the Mongol warrior was the double-banded bow. And they used to shoot the bow galloping on horseback. They had developed it to such a science that those of you who have ridden horses, I rode horses all my youth, it's not the most stable of platforms to shoot anything. But when a horse is galloping, there is a split second when all four hoofs are off the ground. The horse is actually airborne. The Mongol warriors used to shoot 6 arrows in that time of less than 1 second. And because they were most of them right-handed, they say that their right shoulder, if you looked at a Mongol warrior, you would think he was deformed, because his right shoulder and arm was hugely developed out of proportion than the left. Intense physical training and toughness. Extensive intelligence about opposition. Speed of communication and response. Genghis Khan's communication channels, which was across Asia and China, Asia and Europe, on horseback riding, was the fastest living transmission of records until the invention of the railway. Doing the unexpected, the Chinese built the Great Wall of China to keep the Mongols out. The Mongols never went near the Great Wall of China. They went over the mountain. And the last one is complete and sheer ruthlessness. Genghis Khan had a formula. When he came to a city, they would pitch a white tent. The first day they would pitch a white tent. The meaning of the white tent was surrender as you are now. Only your leaders will be killed. Everyone else will be left. The city will belong to us, but no one else will be killed. Next day, they would put a red tent. And the red tent meant that all men will be killed, women and children will be enslaved, but they will not be killed. Great choice. Third day, they would put a black tent. And the black tent meant that every living thing would be slaughtered, including cats and dogs and sheep and whatever, anything that moves will be killed. And they actually did that. When Genghis Khan attacked the Muslim kingdom of Khwarizm, Samarkand, Bukhara, all these cities were completely wiped out. In one city, they killed 1.7 million men, women and children in a period of 6 hours. 6 hours. And remember, they were not using machine guns. They were using swords. So every sword stroke, you're talking about 1.7 million and more sword strokes. Now imagine the sheer ruthlessness of all that. So they asked Genghis Khan, they asked him, and this is recorded, they asked him, why do you do that? What's the motivation behind this empire building? And he made what I consider to be the most short-term focused statement that I've ever heard in my life. He said, for the joy of chasing my enemy, killing him and taking his women. Can you imagine anything more short-term focused than that? But highly, hugely successful. That's the... These are the puzzles of leadership that I'm fascinated with, and I have finished my 26th book on it. So what remains today of this entire world, and why did I tell you the whole story? What remains today of Genghis Khan's empire, an empire the like of which the world never saw till today, the largest empire that was ever built by mankind? What is left today? Hold your breath. One stone pillar base, which is shaped like a turtle. Absolutely nothing else. One stone pillar base, which is shaped like a turtle, from the city that his grandson Ogdai Khan built, called Karakoram. There is a Karakoram highway in Central Asia, but there is no Karakoram. One pillar base. My submission to all of you is, what will remain when you are gone? Because I don't think there is anybody here who has an empire the size of Genghis Khan. We come to the next one, which is Gandhiji. Mahatma Gandhi's 2nd October 1869 to 30th of January 1948. 79 years. What were Gandhiji's principles? And this is another seminar that I teach. According to me, there were three classic principles of leadership of Gandhiji. Clear and simple goal. WIIFM is the FM station that everyone listens to. Every one of you. You know the station? WIIFM. What's in it for me? And Gandhiji translated that very clearly. Anyone who was there knew what's in it for him. Clear and simple goal, not complicated, complex, high-level vision statements. Clear and simple goal. Number two, visible success, which builds credibility. And number three, clear action plan. And the foundation of that, no matter how eccentric people might think Gandhiji was, nobody can deny that he lived by his principles. You may agree with his principles, you may disagree with them, you may like them, you may dislike them, that is immaterial. Nobody will say that Gandhiji did not live by his principles, because he did. The foundation of living by your principles and leadership strategy, clear simple goals, visible success, clear action plan. So what are the principles of Gandhiji's leadership? Clarity about core philosophy. Truth and ahimsa. Truth and non-violence. Willingness to live by those values, no matter what happens. No matter who likes it, who doesn't like it, how popular or unpopular he becomes, but willingness to live by those values. Three is ability to take diverse people along. Peoples of all religions, people of all racial, ethnic background and so on, who followed Gandhiji. Number four, using symbols to fire the imagination. And I'll give you a very classic example of that. And the fifth one is magnanimity to win over opposition. So in Genghis Khan's case, you have a very short-term focus. In Gandhiji's case, you have a very long-term focus. And what is the result? We'll come to that, but before that, I told you I'll give you an example of using of symbols. The Dundee March to make salt on the seashore. What was the Dundee March all about? It was not about making salt. But it was about challenging the British Empire's right to make laws. Very simple goal. Walk to Dundee. Make salt. But it shook the foundations of the British Empire. What remains today? This remains today. Our nation. The third of the examples I want to give you before we come to the tools is the example of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, 570 to 632, 62 to 63 years of life, out of which 23 of those years as a prophet. What were his leadership principles? Once again, living the message, walking the talk, not saying something and doing something else. Number two, putting himself on the line, not telling someone else to do what he would not do himself. There was a commotion very early in the morning before Fajr in Medina, and people were running helter-skelter. They thought they had been attacked, and at that time they saw a rider on riding bareback coming back from the boundary of Medina. And that rider was the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam himself. He said, "There is no danger. I just went to check." Putting himself on the line. Number three, the goal comes first before personal preferences. The finest example of the ability to deal with people you dislike. Today, one of the biggest reasons why we are very bad at teamwork is because we insist that the people we work with must necessarily be people we like personally. Whereas the reality is that you need the skills and talents of people. You don't necessarily need to like them. It is the ability to work with people that we don't necessarily like which is at the root of successful team building. And the Prophet ﷺ did that to a level of excellence. Again, I'm not going into details. We don't have the time for that. There's a book of mine called Leadership Lessons from the Life of Rasulullah ﷺ. I would recommend to FEMA to get the book and give each one of you a copy of that. I don't take any royalty from the books. I'm not trying to sell the book. But just so that you have an example of the life of the Prophet written from a perspective which is modern, which links with our life challenges today in business, in politics, in administration, taking from the lessons from the life of the Prophet. And I'm sure you would be interested to read that. And the last one, very, very, very important. Magnanimity and forgiveness. How do you join hearts together? By forgiving each other. Who do you forgive? Somebody who wronged you. By definition, you can't forgive someone who's always been good to you. But unless you can forgive somebody who wronged you, hearts will never join. And according to me today, this is the number one need, not only of India, but of the whole world. And that number one need is to join the hearts of people together. Do you agree with me? And that can only happen if we learn to forgive one another. So I say the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam overcame enemies not by killing enemies, but by killing enmity. And so those enemies, people who were after his blood literally, became his greatest friends and supporters. What remains today? 1.5 billion people across nations, my nationalities, races, geographies, who love him and believe in him and accept his message. What is his legacy? The Quran and the Sunnah, the concept of the oneness of Allah, and the concept of accountability in the hereafter, which we call Tawheed and Akhirah. The forgiveness of Allah, the beautiful ayat of Surah Al-Furqan, which my brother recited so beautifully, mashallah, is one of those ayat where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, the one who seeks forgiveness, not only will Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala forgive his sins, but he will convert them into good deeds. And whenever I read this ayah, I say only the King of Kings can do this. Forgiveness alone would have been enough. But imagine converting those sins into actual good deeds in the account of the individual. يُبَدِّلُونَهُ What is the ayat? يُبَدِّلُ اللَّهُ سَيِّئَاتِهِمْ حَسَنَاتٍ جَزَاكُمُ اللَّهُ خَيْرًا. Then Allah will change the sayyat, the sins, into hasanat, which is good deeds. Three, charity as an act of worship, as one of the pillars of Islam. Not something which is good to do, but something which you have to do, and if you deny that, then you are out of Islam. Charity as an act of worship. Egalitarianism, which people don't really understand, but egalitarianism, brotherhood of mankind, not only of faith. Last week I was in London, after Oxford I was in London. I was speaking at a function of Muslims and non-Muslims. There's a dear friend of mine and one of my teachers, Sheikh Ahmad Babakir, who has an annual event. He calls it Come Dine With Me. And the event is each Muslim bring a non-Muslim friend with you. So we had over 200 people. There were Hindus, Christians, Jewish people and so on and so forth in that hall. And we talked about, and one of the things I talked about was the brotherhood of humanity, the brotherhood of mankind, not just a brotherhood of faith, which a lot of people don't know, including Muslims. And that's one of the legacies of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Fifth one is a legal system before which there is absolute equality between Muslim and non-Muslim, rich and poor, powerful and powerless. Today one of the four-letter words, which is not four letters, is Sharia. And people talk about imposition of Sharia. And people think that if Sharia is imposed as a law, the non-Muslims will get a raw deal. If the Sharia is imposed as a law, the way it is supposed to be imposed, I'm not talking about how it is imposed in many places, which is not Sharia at all. If it is done the way it is supposed to be done, there is absolutely no differentiation between Muslim and non-Muslim before the law. Complete equality in the rights of people with no distinction between Muslim and non-Muslim. Rights of women, I always say, in my next incarnation, if there is one, and we don't believe in incarnation, we believe in standing before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but if there was a philosophy of incarnation which we believed in, I always say that if I was to be reincarnated, I would like to be reincarnated as my wife. Because the rights of women in Islam actually exceed the rights of men. That this might come as a big surprise to many of you. And as I told you, we don't have time to go into the details, but as and when there is time, I'm happy to elaborate all this for you. But just to give you one statistic, I don't know how many of you are aware, and I can give you the numbers and the links and the references. To this day, data correct to 2014, women in America get 20% less money for the same work. To this day. Same thing in Europe. Of course, same thing in India. Why? We like to talk about the equality of women. Where is it? And to the best of my knowledge, there is no Sharia being applied in America or in Europe or in India. So what's this equality of women we talk about? Where is it? Give it to me. We want that to happen. Why must a woman get less money for the same work than a man just because she is from a different gender? How is it fair? Number six, a constitution, the first such document in the history of mankind to be written down when the Prophet ﷺ went to Medina, which guarantees equal rights for everyone irrespective of faith. Think about this. The Prophet of the Muslims writes a document which gives equal rights to the Jews and to the people who were the people of Quraysh and others who worshipped idols. So they were not Hindu in the sense that we understand Hinduism, but they used to worship idols. Same rights as his own followers. And finally, an unparalleled example of personal life as a guidance for all mankind. And that is the legacy of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. So we come to the tools. Therefore, what must you do? Having seen these three examples of great leaders, what must you do? How can you translate that into your life? And I say, put your life in gear. And as you know, if you can have the most powerful engine, you sit in the Ferrari, Enzo Ferrari, you've got over 200 HP, the car can do 300 miles per hour, but unless you engage the gear, you can step on the gas for all your worth, the engine will scream, it will burn itself out, but you will not move an inch because you have not engaged the gear. Right or not? So it's not the horsepower, it's the whether you engage the gear. So therefore, put your life in gear. What is gear? Generate energy, energize others, achieve results, and return to society. That's my concept of gear. Very quickly, let's go through that. Generate energy, power up your life. Number one, very clear, very important to be clear and rooted in your values. What are your values? One of the things I teach is, I call it my core leadership workshop, which begins with core values. What are your core values? What are the values that you will not compromise for anything on the face of the earth? You need to be clear about that, and you need to be deeply rooted in them. That was the biggest strength of Gandhiji, for example. Very clear about his values. Number two, live those values with confidence. Not hide under the table. No apologetic appearance. Live the values with confidence. Three, be prepared to commit fully, because that is the meaning of commitment. There's no such thing as partial commitment. Just like there's no such thing as partial pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not pregnant. So you're either committed or you're not committed. You can't be partially committed to something. Values drive passion, and passion rarely fails. So what are right values? Those in which you believe passionately, those which you will do anything for, those you will not compromise at any cost, and those which add value to you and others. They can be anything, but they must follow these four principles. And as we know, and we have seen that recently in the subprime crisis in the US, in the financial collapse of the global capital markets and so on, greed self-destructs. And that's why I say to you, it's not how much you have, but how much you want, which determines satisfaction and peace of mind. There's a wonderful teaching story of this man who was in great need, and he was running, going from place to place, asking people to help him, and nobody could help him. Finally, he was in absolute desperation, in despair. He was going, and he found an old fakir sitting under a tree. And the man called him. He said, "Come here." He said, what's the problem?" He said, "No, I desperately need some money. I don't have anything. Anyway, what can you give me? You are a fakir. You are a beggar." So the fakir put his hand under the mat he was sitting on, and he pulled out a diamond that size. And he gave it to him. He said, "Take it." He saw it. He said, "What is this?" He said, "It's a diamond." "What's it worth?" He said, "Go ask the jewelers." He said, "You're giving it to me?" He said, "Yeah, take it." The man took it and he ran away. Next day, the man came back to the fakir. So the fakir said to him, "What happened? You couldn't sell it?" He said, No. He said, "I went and I found out the price of this thing. He says it's worth millions." So he said, "Then what happened?" He said, "I came to give it back to you." He said, "Why?" He said, "Because I want from you that which made you give me that stone. What is it that you have where you gave me that stone? I want that, because that is worth more than whatever the stone is worth. That contentment of the heart." My brothers and sisters, the essential truth is that living life is about making choices. Choosing to be a victim or choosing to be a master. You might say, "Well, how can anyone choose to be a victim?" Believe me, if you do not choose to be a master, you chose to be a victim. Both stances, whether you choose to be a master or victim, are subject to the givens of society and the environment. Conditions will not change just because you decide to take a masterful stance. But what does change are the implications in terms of your own development and your own happiness. Choose wisely, because the implications are for the here and the hereafter. I submit to you that success has a price. Like everything else, success has a price. When you leave this hall, let's do an experiment. When you finish after dinner and you're going home, find the first person that you can see and ask them, "Do you want to be successful or unsuccessful?" What do you think he will say? or she will say, I want to be the most unsuccessful person in the world. If they say that, that's a success statement. He doesn't want to be any ordinary unsuccessful. The most unsuccessful, the biggest failure. Everybody wants success. But does everybody have success? What's your experience? What does it tell you? Is everyone successful? So just wanting success is not sufficient. People do not have success for the same reason that everyone does not have a Rolls Royce. And what's the reason? Because they are not willing to pay the price of the Rolls Royce. Just wanting a Rolls Royce will not get you a Rolls Royce. So I go to the Rolls Royce showroom and I say, I've come here to buy this car. So sales guy says, how much money do you have? I said, I have 1 lakh. I have 100,000 rupees in my pocket. So he says, please come here. He sits me down in front of his nice laptop. He shows me a 3D model of the Rolls Royce. And he says, move your finger around on the pad and it will turn. And if you click here, the bonnet will open. If you click here, the doors will open. All of that. When you are finished with that, leave your 1 lakh there and go home. For 1 lakh, you get to see a 3D model of the car. Success has a price. People don't get success because they're not willing to pay the price. And the reason why most people are not willing to pay the price is not because they don't want to, but because they don't know what is the price. They never thought of success as having a price. This man is a mind reader. Most people are, they don't pay the price of success because they don't know the price of success, and they don't know the prices of success because they haven't thought about it. So my first question to you was what? When I began this presentation, what do you want to do about your future? My second question to you is, before you go to bed tonight, define success in your own terms. Do not go to sleep until you write a success statement. What does success mean to me? Will you do that? Do not go to bed without writing a success statement for yourself. When you go home, also gather about you, your family, tell each of them to do that. And the price of success is not in terms of money, it's in terms of actions. What is it that you are not doing today that you need to start doing? What is it that you are doing today which you need to stop doing? And what is it that you are doing today which you need to continue to do consciously? We come to the next one, which is energizing of others. And why do we need to do that? Because nobody can win alone. Three things to do. Build a team. Create a foundation of trust, because that's what the team is built on. And number three, very important, learn to deal with conflict. Leverage conflict to enhance quality, to bring together hearts, to enable people to understand each other better. Not avoid conflict, leverage conflict, use conflict. Focus on your people and understand the doorman is also people. There's a wonderful story about G.R.D. Tata, told by his driver. He said that G.R.D. Tata used to work in, at that time he was chairman of Air India, so he used to work in Air India building for half the day. And the rest of the day, he would go to the Tata headquarters and he would eat lunch in the Tata headquarters. So the man says that I was waiting for him one day and he came down personally from the top of Air India building and came and said to him, today I'm not going to Tata House. You go and have lunch and come back and pick me up at such and such time because I have some meetings here. The driver is also people. The doorman is also people. If G.R.D. had not come personally, if he had sent a message, the driver would not have been offended. It's not about the driver. It's about the man himself. Build your team. Critical question. Who must be on the team and who must not be on the team? Everybody has value, but some people have nuisance value. Such people must always be on the team. Please understand, not off the team. It is much better for a person to be in the tent and do it outside rather than be outside and do it into the tent. Since it's a dinner meeting, I don't want to say what. And the last one is, What will make them want to be there? Nobody commits for money. Please understand this very clearly. There are statistics to prove this. Passion is a matter of the heart. Money has to come. Nobody works for free. You have to pay salaries and you have to pay good salaries. But the salary will not buy you commitment. The salary will not buy you passion. You need passion. Because only the right people can go to the right place. Foundation of this is trust. What is trust? Demonstrated competence plus willingness to help times time. People trust you if they believe that you can do something for them and you are available to them. This is what we have to prove to our people, not once, time and time again. To build trust, six things to do. Demonstrate integrity and competence, demonstrate objectivity and impartiality, demonstrate willingness to help, communicate and collaborate, support others, and cover up other people's faults, not show them up. Cover people's faults. Be proactive in helping others. Don't wait to be asked. And that's why one of my first managers in Guyana, South America, in the middle of the boondocks. I worked 5 years in the middle of the Amazonian rainforest. And I had a manager called Nick Adams. And Nick used to ask me this question. He used to say, what is your bank balance? And I was very poor in those days. So I said, I want nothing. He said, no, I'm not talking about that money. I thought he's going to give me a raise or something. He said, I'm talking about your goodwill bank balance. He said, it works the same way. What you can draw out depends on what you put in. If you did not put it in, you cannot draw it out. When do you put it in? When you don't need it. So you can draw it out when you need it. Many people, they value things and they use people. And that's a formula for failure. We need to value people and use things. We collect things. We don't collect people. We should collect people. Give away the things. Give away the things, Allah is going to question you about them. Why do you want to collect them? For what? You want to answer all those questions? Collect people. Good people. That should be your collection. Who are the friends you have? Not stuff. Leverage conflict. Create a culture of mutual respect. Not denigrating and criticizing people because they disagree with you. Disagree without being disagreeable. In Islamic sciences, we have something called adabul istilaf, the manners of disagreeing. How to disagree. It is taught as a subject. Adabul istilaf, how to disagree. Very important lesson in team building. We need to learn the manners of disagreeing and use conflict as a resource. And that's why I say only appropriate heat tempers steel and welds metal to metal. If you increase the heat, the iron will melt and flow away. It won't join. Third one, achievements, because only results count. We can talk till the cows come home. End of the day, only thing which counts is what did you actually do. Three things to do that. What's your strategy? What's your roadmap? What are your metrics? Measurement factors. Strategy, what is the method you want to follow to achieve your vision? Clarity about the vision. Clarity about how to get there. How do you know this will work? That is critical to be able to demonstrate that, because you will get commitment from people based on your ability to demonstrate that your method works. Third one is, what is the investment you need to make for your strategy to succeed? And once again, investment is not only money. For the most part, money is the last part of investment. You need quick and significant wins to retain the energy, and so you must know what are the leverage points of your strategy. Many times we get sidetracked by the appearance of action. You're very busy. But you stop for a minute and say, you're busy doing what? You have no clue. It's not the appearance of action. It is actual results that must come from that. Number two is roadmap. Systematic working. What are the road milestones? What are the metrics? How do you know you're going in the right direction at the right speed? What are the timelines by which you will reach each milestone? A goal without a timeline is only a wish. And the last one, very important, set the metrics, measurement parameters. We call this the SMART goals. A goal must be specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, and time-bound. SMART. So any goal you have, put it on this framework and say, is it a SMART goal? I'm going to give you this complete presentation for those of you who are interested. Just if you contact Mr. Manshauddin, he will email you the link and you will get the whole presentation. Two kinds of goals, being goals and doing goals. Many of us start off with the being, I want to be this, I want to be that. But to be that, you have to do something. And unless you translate a being goal into a doing goal, it's never going to happen. So if I want to be the CEO of my company, what do I need to do? Take any being goal and translate it into a doing goal. And so my quote for that is, to be, you have to do. To do, you don't have to be. You don't have to wait until you become in order to do. Unless you do, you will never be. To be, you have to do. To do, you don't have to be. Unless you do, you will never be. If you can say that very fast, 5 times, I'll give you $1 million. To be. So therefore, measure yourself. And this is your third task. First task, what will you do about your future? Second task, write your own success statement. Third task, measure yourself. In the last 12 months, what did you learn? Can you write down 3 critical learnings that you have? Write down, not talk about it. Can you write down 3 critical things that you learned in the last 12 months? Number 2, out of those 3, how many did you actually apply? Number 3, what is your investment in yourself in the last 12 months? And I want you to put a number on it. Not I worked very hard. No, not hard. How much? What number? Number 4, what was your return on that investment? Success comes from clarity. That clarity is absolutely critical. And that success is in the life of this world and in the hereafter, which we call Akhirah. Why must we measure ourselves? Because we will be measured. One of the famous quotes of the Khalifa Umar bin al-Khattab radhiyallahu anhu, he said, take your hisab before your hisab is taken. He said, assess yourself before you are assessed. Last one is return to the world. Why? Because we took from it. Every time I speak to a group of people, you can't see that because I can't beam that picture from my mind into your minds, but I can actually see the faces of all those people who are my teachers. Formal and informal teachers. Most of them are gone because I'm 60 years old. So I mean, you know, they would have to be 120 to be alive now. But I can see their faces in my mind. And I honor them. And I know that if it wasn't for them, I would not be even a fraction of what I am today. And most of them were not Muslim. Most of them were not Muslim. We lived in a society like that. We lived in a society in the middle of people. We loved each other. The religion didn't matter. We didn't love them because they were Muslim or because they were... No, we loved each other because we were human beings. So return. Share the wealth. All kinds of wealth. Knowledge. Money. Energy, help, share the wealth. Why? Because that's the way to get rich. You don't get rich by hoarding, you get rich by sharing. The principle of agriculture, which I will come to in a second. You get rich by sharing. Give to get. Abundance philosophy. Many people tell me, almost everywhere I go and everywhere I teach, I say to the people the same thing I said to you, which is, I will give you this entire presentation. People tell me, you're mad, you're crazy. This is your capital. This is, my capital is knowledge. I'm a consultant, so my capital is knowledge. I charge money for this. Why do you give it for free? This is like Bill Gates giving away, you know, Microsoft Word or something, or Apple giving away iPhones. I have done this all my life. And I have been hugely enriched by that, believe me. I don't do this more because I'm being kind to you, no. I know this is my way of getting more and more and more. The knowledge that comes back to me when I share is far superior to whatever I give you. So share abundance philosophy. Don't hoard. Return to society and create a legacy. Give to get because only empty hands can hold. Because wealth is not how much you have, but how much you can afford to give. Being wealthy is a state of mind, not a state of the pocket. What you have in your hand is the harvest. What you plant is the seed. Hang on to what you have, and that's all you will ever have. Plant what you have, and you will always get more. Because the harvest is always more than the seed. So give what you have to get what you need. And more. My brothers and sisters, life is math. 2 + 4 = 6. Life is math because this equation is our equation in life. We control only one side of the equation. The other side is given to us. The 2 is mine. The 4 is given to me. But what I do with the 2 will affect, will impact the outcome, which is the 6. So if I want to convert the 6 into 8, what must I do with the 2? Make it 4. Many times people say, well, you know what, this happened to me. No problem. It happened to you. What did you do? We control one side of the equation, but we do control that side of the equation. And what we do with that side of the equation has an impact on the final outcome, which is the only thing which matters. And that's why I say life is math. The only way to get is to give. You want people to trust you? Hide their faults. Don't talk about them. People will trust you. You want people to care for you? You want caring? Show concern for others. Care for others. You want to have fun? Laugh. You want respect? Be thankful to people. You want harmony? Accept differences. Don't insist that somebody should be like you. No. Accept differences. You want appreciation? Appreciate. Don't be critical. You want happiness? Forgive mistakes. You want to get? Give. Return to society because strong societies are built on giving. I'll tell you a wonderful story. Ford Foundation ran a program in North India, in UP, where it was an agriculture program. And very simple thing, they gave people metal plowshares. You know, the Nagar Marte, na? So, the Nagar Marte, Lagdi ka hota hai. It's a wooden plowshare, the thing which goes into the ground. Ford Foundation ran this thing, and they gave people in a particular village, they gave them metal plowshare. The metal plowshare digs deeper, breaks up the soil better, so the fossil, the crop, is better than with a wooden plowshare. So they did this experiment. They had some experimental fields. They had control fields. They demonstrated to the village people that I'm talking about giving. So they demonstrated to the village people that the metal plowshare is superior, gives you better harvest and so on and so forth. 2 years later, they came back for assessment of the project and they found that the metal plowshares were not being used. They were amazed. They were absolutely flabbergasted. They said, how is it that people are not using it? I mean, these Indians are stupid or what? So they spoke to the Patwari and the Patel of the village and so on. And of course, our people are very polite. So they said, you don't like it? No, of course, sir, we like it very much. And aap to itna dur se aaye, hamare liye aapne itna sab kiya. We said, wo sahi hai, aap karte kyun nahi? Nahi, wo aap. So they never got a straight answer from them. So they hired one of my professors when I was at the IMA in Ahmedabad called Pulin Garg. So they asked Pulin to go and talk to them. Now, Pulin used to always wear a dhoti and so on and so forth, and he was from that general area. So, Pulin told me the story. Pulin said to me, I went there. He said, Do din hum wahan pe rahe. He said, I stayed in the village. And then asked the people, I said, humko to batao. Ye gore ko nahi bata, humko to batao. He said, you didn't tell the white man the story, but tell me, you know, what is the issue? I mean, you don't like this thing, the plowshare? They said, no, they are correct. The plowshare is very good. gives us a better harvest and so on and so forth. So, he said, then why don't you use it? The answer that man gave, the village elder, blew me away. He said to Pulin, I'll say this in Hindi and then I will translate it for you, those of you who don't know Hindi. He said, sir, ये लोहे का हम इस्तेमाल करें तो हमारे गांव में जो जो बढ़ाई है जो बढ़ाई का खानदान है इनका हम क्या करेंगे. He said, if we use the metal plowshare, what must we do with the family of carpenters which lives in our village? Now imagine. Yeah? This is our culture. This is our culture. He said, so the whole village takes a decision to take a lower crop, lower income, because we have to support the carpenters whose only job is to make this. Strong societies are built on sharing and giving. Growth for the sake of growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell. Growth for the sake of growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell. And that is what has happened to us as a society. Being well adjusted to sickness is not a sign of health. And that's a quote of Jiddu Krishnamurti, one of my favorite philosophers which I have read a lot of. He said, being well adjusted to sickness is not a sign of health. And that's why I say to you, my brothers and sisters, honor is never old-fashioned. Last slide, or second last slide, is develop leadership. Put back into society. I teach leadership. I charge a fee to my corporate clients only. All others, which is over 80% of my practice, I do it for free. I'm not saying it so that you will think I'm a great guy. I'm saying it to show that even somebody like me, who is a single individual, can do if you want to do. Schools, colleges, students, teachers, religious organizations, irrespective of the religion, religious organizations, scholars, gatherings like this, all of them, I do this work for free. Why? I'm not doing anybody any favor. I'm doing it because I got it from society. I need to give it back. So select, write, and train. Monitor, write, hands-on. Support and critique, say what needs to be said. And then hand over charge. One of the greatest reasons why family businesses break up is because the elders don't want to hand over to the youngsters. They send them to the... किसी के दिल को लगी बात है? सच बोल रहा ना? And the interesting thing is that at least in today's world, many business families, they send their children to some of the finest institutions in the world. So you get these youngsters with a brilliant education from Princeton, from Harvard, from Cambridge, from Oxford, and then his father will not trust him to change a light bulb. So what to do with his education? Seriously, we have to trust our own training. If you have confidence in the way you trained your son, you will never fear to hand over charge. There is a very, very good friend of mine. He is a disciple of one of our very famous gurus from India. So he told me a wonderful story. He said that he has a son who is about 21 years old. So he said the Guruji came, so he went to him and so on, and he asked his son wanted to go to America. And these people, they are, you know, traditional Brahmin family, very traditional people. So they were very afraid. He goes to America, what will happen and so on. And you know the biggest fear that we have of sending our sons to America. So anyway, so this person said, I went to my guru and I asked him, I said, Guruji, ke ye ladka bahut tang kar raha hai America, tum mai usko bhejun ya nahi bhejun? He said, he's after my life, he wants to go to America. Should I send him or should I not send him? And that guru gave him an answer which seriously, such so simple but so correct. He said to him, ke America bhejna ya nahi bhejna, वो आपने इस लड़के के साथ 21 साल जो किया उस पर डिपेंड करता है. Is it to send the son to America or not depends on what you did with him for 21 years. And that's so important in terms of understanding, you know, what we do. Because if you want to leave behind a legacy, you have to develop leadership. Last slide I want to submit to you. People remember us not by what we consumed, but by what we contributed. Whatever we owned is... But what did you give back to people, to society? And that's what we are remembered for. That's a set of my books. This is the last slide. Those are my links. Those of you who are interested, most welcome. Please contact. Please be in touch. It will be wonderful to hear from you. The Tumblr link has my quotes. Current count, there are actually 4 books that are going to come out of the quotes. So you'll be interested. Those of you who are interested, take a screenshot of that. Anyway, I will send you this presentation which has all of this. Thank you very much. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here in Kuwait, to be at this function, to talk to you. My thanks to His Excellency, our Ambassador, and to all of you for taking the time and trouble to come here. It's a great honor for me. I'm most grateful to you. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.